BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
We have football coming out of our ears right now. You and I sat around all summer, and what did we talk about? What is Aaron Rodgers going to do? What could Bo Nix do in his rookie season? Did the Atlanta Falcons make a mistake by drafting Michael Penix? Will the Ducks be able to play deep in the college football playoff? What will Oregon State and Washington State look like? Well, now it is officially upon us in so many ways. We've got football on Thursday night. We've got football streaming on Peacock. We've got Monday night football ahead with Aaron Rodgers making his comeback against the 49ers. Bo Nix is going to get his first start as a rookie. Oregon going to try to bounce back after a... Is it such a thing as a disappointing win? I guess. A disappointing win. That's where the standards are in Eugene right now. Oregon State going on the road. They are flying out today. They will land in San Diego shortly. They'll play San Diego State tomorrow. Texas Tech, Washington State in Pullman on Fox. Coach Prime against Nebraska, or is it Colorado against Nebraska? We'll talk about that on today's show as well. I'm just saying, we've got football coming out of our ears all of a sudden. I hope you take a moment to enjoy it. People say that to athletes all the time. I'll ask that question in a news conference, or if I'm talking to a player by their locker or talking to a coach. I've asked this question to Kyle Whittingham just this summer. I said, do you have a chance to enjoy it when you're in the middle of it? And they will often say what? They say, oh, no, you can't really stop to smell the roses. You can't really look around and enjoy it. If you do, you kind of get caught. That's not the job. And they talk about being forward-thinking. They're always looking at the horizon. They're talking about the living in the now. Players, they want players to think ahead. This is the Super Bowl this week. So, no, they probably don't enjoy it as much as they should. So just make sure, while we're watching Thursday night football and then Friday night football in Brazil and then a bunch of Saturday college football and then a Sunday that starts with just a full-fledged, the NFL season is on kind of feel to it, and then Monday night football, just take a moment in the next 72 hours or so to kind of realize, like, hey, if you're a football fan and you love football, if you're a true American is what I'm asking, then you should be enjoying this weekend. We got a great show for you today. We're going to get a visit from Boise State's athletic director. Jeremiah Dickey will be joining us. He is boots on the ground in Eugene. We'll take the temperature with this Boise State team and what this game means to it. And frankly, what Boise State is thinking about with the expanded playoff and the group of five and the house settlement seemingly teetering now after everybody thought they had a settlement. So we'll check in with Boise State's athletic director in the 4 o'clock hour. Anna will be here for the 5 at 5. Judah Newby's in the hot seat today. Judah, can I just ask you, you're a football fan. I know you're a football fan. You're a Seahawks guy. It's going to be Bo Nix against the Seahawks over the weekend. We spent a lot of time talking about all this stuff. Now we got all these games coming out of our ears.
It's really great. And then watching Ravens Chiefs last night and just catching the end of it with my wife. And I just looked at her and I said, you know, you couldn't script a better opening to the football season. And it's incredible how the product still delivers, John. But I think that's a good message, because even with the football all this weekend, I'm like, wow, it's already September 6th. You know, just a blink of an eye ago, it was Big Ten Media Day, you know, in July, and we were pining away for September football. Now it's here, and you're right. We should savor it and enjoy it while it's here.
Here's my question for our listeners today, right off the top of the show. We're going to get to whether or not listeners think Bo Nix will be successful. We're going to get to some of the college football questions. But, you know, you saw the Chiefs prevail in a wild ending last night as the Ravens' touchdown gets waved off on, you know, a final play, and you have a whole bunch of people that, you know, are going, this is great, this is the NFL. And it's true, like, when you go back and you look statistically at the NFL games from last season, there were so many games that come down to one possession. The NFL gets it and is gamed a little bit to set up these back and forths that come down and so many one score games. But do you think that is better than college football? Because college football is striving in so many ways to be like the NFL. You've seen rule changes like the 2-minute timeout, 2-minute warning, like the NFL. I'm watching, by the way, I have no use for the NFL kickoff. We'll get to that later. But I'm watching all of this unfold, and I'm going, there's still something about the college game that I like better. And you know what it is? It's the fans. It's the regionality of it. It's that not everything is the same. As much as we complain and bellyache that there are imbalances in college football, some of those imbalances make college football quirky and different. And it's why when an Appalachian State beats a Michigan, it's like it feels like the NCAA tournament. It's why when Idaho plays Oregon close, people go, gosh, man, that's Idaho. Their roster gets picked over in the transfer portal. And against Oregon, like the number three team in the country, like how did that happen? And I just think there are some differences with the college game that I like more. But I want to throw this out to listeners. Like, do you think that college football should strive to be more like the NFL? Because the NFL, what does it do? It has rules. It has clock management. It has the draft. It has a hard salary cap that really does set up and foster parity. And when you look at the number of one-score games by the end of this season, you're going to see that like 65 to 75% of the games in the NFL come down to not the final play maybe, but come down to one possession or one score.
He's first four. Lamar trying to make magic happen. Throw it in zone. Way, 2 feet down. Yes! Touchdown! What a play! Isaiah Likely!
Let's make sure. Oh, very close. The NBC camera crew is unbelievable, and the Ravens wish they were a little less.
And you're going to hear this crowd go crazy with the call from John Hockley.
The runner's toe hit out of bounds. It's an incomplete pass. The game is over. Kansas City has won.
That is the NFL. That's how the season started. Remember how the season ended with the Chiefs in overtime in a Super Bowl. This is what the NFL does. Do you want this to be college football, or do you appreciate the nuances and quirks and differences that college football has? I've heard coaches talk about why aren't the hashes the same. I've heard coaches talk about why is it 2 feet in, not 1 feet in, 1 foot in. Coaches are saying, I wish the rules were more like the NFL. Dan Lanning said, I wish every rule was like the NFL so that we could have a uniform system. 503-417-7575. You tell me, because I thought last night was a great example of one of the things the NFL does really well is it gives you these made-for-TV one-score classic games, quarterbacks, advantages to quarterbacks and receivers as they can march down the field in a 2-minute drill and a whole bunch of other things. Judah Newby, do you appreciate the college game for what it is, or do you want it to be more like the NFL?
I can't say both, but part of it's the schedule, right? Like the NFL, you're going to be able to flex your best game into prime time on Sunday night late in the year. You get some degree of that with the 6-day selection window. You know, everything's made for TV, and the 6-day selection window does some of that in college football too, but you're not really going to see a lot of the equivalent of the FBS versus FCS games. And yet at the same time, John, it's that scheduling disparity, one would say, that gave us Michigan-Appalachian State, that gave us a 10-point game between Oregon and Idaho that no one saw coming, right? I mean, like every once in a while, these big Davids or these Davids that face big Goliaths win the game. And you don't get that kind of upset feel nearly as often in the NFL. And that's what makes college football kind of great in its own right. Plus, I like the fans in college football more than I like the NFL fans.
100%. NFL fans are all punching each other on social media.
I'm to a bunch of Seahawk road games, and sometimes it's good just to get out of there alive, it feels like. But I know Duck fans go to Autzen, and they've said the same things, though. You know, there's unruly fans everywhere you go. But I love the students, and I love the band. The band is awesome. I know callers have said that before. The band really makes college, that atmosphere feel really good. So I don't know if I come out fully on one side or the other, but I do love the closeness of some NFL
games. You like them both, though.
Yeah.
So I'm with you in that I like them both, and therefore I want them to be different. Like, I like right. the things that you're talking about. I like when I pull into the parking lot of a college stadium, Racer Stadium, Autzen Stadium, you know, San Diego State on tomorrow night, wherever that game is, that I pull it. It doesn't matter across the country. I've been to so many games. You pull into the parking lot, and you immediately get a feel for the fan base and a feel for the culture of the program and the culture of the fan base. And then, you know, there's the stadiums that, you know, they're not all NFL-style stadiums. Some of these stadiums are truly in college towns, and they feel different because of that. And then you get into the games, and, you know, even in the season opener of the college football season, we get this weird game in Dublin, Ireland, where, you know, the broadcast crew is drinking, and Florida State is supposed to win this game against Georgia Tech, right? Like, Florida State was like a double-digit favorite in this game, and we find out, lo and behold, this team's not very good. And there's a surprise there. Like, I guess that could happen in the NFL, but I'm going to take a look at one-score games in major college football, not involving FCS, FBS matchups, but one-score games this season. And I have no doubt that there will be far more NFL games that are one-score games, come down to the end. It just seems like every game is like that.
You know, and it's funny, last night, Chiefs-Ravens, Chiefs were in control. It was 20-10 entering the fourth quarter, and part of me didn't think it was going to be a close game. Like, part of me is like, I don't see it from the Ravens. Like, they got 3 points after their opening drive touchdown. I don't see it. First play of the fourth quarter is that crazy out of the pocket to Isaiah Likely catch and run, and it takes one play with that athleticism that you don't really get in the college game, that level of athleticism. It takes one play like that in the NFL to turn a not close game into a close game, and the NFL's got an upper hand on college football in that regard.
I think I like the differences. I like the nuances. I'd love to hear from listeners. Do you want college football to be more like the NFL or not? 503-417-7575. Also, we're watching this kickoff rule change, and I understand why they're doing this. One of the very last stories that I did, I was on the NFL beat. I was the NFL columnist of the San Jose Mercury News before coming to the state of Oregon. One of the very last stories I did was during training camp, and it was about the injuries that are suffered on special teams in preseason games. And I talked to a number of players who had serious or devastating injuries. There was a career-ending injury. There were injuries that cost people their money, their livelihood. They cost teams to have to rebuild the roster. And so the question was, like, should you ban special teams plays from preseason games? And, you know, this was long before they evolved to, like, how do we change the kickoff, or, you know, what kind of, you know, this is still when they were in denial about concussions and brain injuries. But it was evident that there was a problem 20 years ago. And so the NFL was talking about it. Everybody, the players were talking about it. And it, you know, you look now and you see how this kickoff thing goes. And I don't like it. I would just as soon that they put the ball on the 25-yard line and tell the offense to go. Just eliminate the kickoff altogether. I just don't like this change. And I'm not one of these people that's against a change for the sake of changing. It just feels to me like this is too big of a deviation. And it's super confusing, and I find myself having to explain it to everybody in the room, and I find myself getting text messages during the game last night from people who, nobody likes this, Judah. What, do you think that this kickoff thing lasts, or are they just tinkering with it now?
I don't think it lasts if everybody's just going to kick touchbacks. And, you know, it was the same thing. My wife was like, why are they doing this? And I was like, well, it was supposed to make the play more exciting, and it was so boring. It was the opposite of what they were trying to accomplish. They were trying to revitalize the play while keeping it safe. And it just looks kind of junior high. You know, it kind of looks just weird. And
XFL-like.
Yeah. So to me, I don't know. I think Roger Goodell's probably looking at it, and he doesn't want his league to be a joke. And it kind of looks like a joke, that specific play. It's not a hill I'm going to die on per se, but I'm with you. Put the ball in the 25, and let's just play ball, right? We don't need the pomp and circumstance of a kickoff to start off every game or every drive.
It's just it's the equivalent of watching, like, somebody get intentionally walked. You know, it's like just a lull in the action. Like, everything else is great, then everybody stops and lines up in this weird formation on the field, and then the kicker kicks the ball into the end zone.
And what baseball do, right? They say, hey, we're not even going to throw the four pitches anymore. Just take first base.
Save some
time.
And so I kind of just wonder. I wonder if the solution is either, you know, I heard Bill Belichick talk about it. He thinks that touchbacks should come out to the 40, and which would really make teams eager to kick it off. But I just think there's no incentive right now for anybody to, you know, like, all right, we'll just kick it through the goalposts. What's the point?
Yeah, one thing I did like is that it made the game play really quick. Like, once there was the touchback, it took like 15 seconds. The offense was back on the field. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but I did like that as opposed to commercial break after every kickoff.
But I just find myself going, like, people going, can you explain this? And the NFL on their homepage has an explainer, the new dynamic kickoff rule explainer. And I'm like, if you have to do that, you might have a problem with how the rule is. Bo Nix is going to get his start, his first rookie start this weekend. He will be at Seattle, the friendly confines in Seattle. Judah, what's he in store for? How good is your team going to be?
I like Seattle. You know, I like Seattle. I think they're going to the playoffs. You know, their win total was like, I know, but I can't help myself. I think they're going to win 9 or 10 games. And Bo, this is going to be an interesting one. Bo's not going to be asked to do a lot. You know, he'll throw probably 17 times. He'll probably be maybe 18. He'll probably be 13 of 18 for $160 and maybe a touchdown. His job is to not throw a pick. His job is to make sure as much as possible he's getting his team in the right formation, which is hard. And that place is going to be on fire, man. It's going to be so loud for him. But they're going to go heavy personnel and run the football and then hope to force Geno into a couple turnovers on the other side and win this game like 20-17. That's Denver's recipe for success. They might do it. I'm not really comfortable with the Seahawks -6, but I do think the Seahawks win in the end. I can't wait to see Bo, though. I'm so impressed by that guy and everything that that he's evolved into. I mean, this guy is starting an NFL game his first week as a rookie, and John, he's been named a team captain of the Denver Broncos. Like, God, this is unfair. Could you imagine Dylan Gabriel this time next year starting as an NFL rookie quarterback and being a team captain of an NFL team? Like, that's wild to me.
I just think the calculus has changed so much, so many similarities between what teams are doing in college football and the NFL, and experience matters. And Brock Purdy, as a rookie, when he came in, I keep coming back to this, people were like, wow, a rookie on this stage, in this situation, and, you know, he played really well. And then everyone goes, well, let's explain, why did he play well? Everybody's looking for the explanation. It was simple. He started 48 games at Iowa State. We saw him in an Alamo Bowl, I think it was, or a Fiesta Bowl. I can't remember. I think it was an Alamo Bowl against Oregon. And it, you know, he was just such a great player, in an experienced player. Bo Nix comes in with 60 starts in college football. That Dylan Gabriel's going to have that as well. And so I think, you know, this isn't like a player who had played two seasons going to the NFL and getting thrown into the fire. This is a 24, soon to be 25-year-old Bo Nix who has a ton of game activity, super mature kid, if you can call him a kid. In a lot of ways, I think Justin Herbert went into the league very similarly equipped because he had been through so much. He'd been through hell at Oregon. I mean, it was, you know, Markelle Fritch recruits him and throws him in late to try to help save me, and, you know, doesn't save Helfrich's job, but then Willie Taggart comes in and kind of rides him as far as he can. He has the collarbone injury. Then Taggart leaves. Herbert's on his third coach in his third year. Here comes Mario Cristobal, who says he wants to throw the ball but doesn't really want to throw the ball. The coordinator is Marcus Arroyo. You got, you know, some success with Herbert in a couple of seasons, and then, frankly, off to the NFL, where it was more of the same as his coaching carousel continued in San Diego and L.A. And it just was interesting to kind of watch Herbert and know, like, everybody who spent any time around him knew that he had the maturity. He had his feet on the ground. He was smart. Everybody, you know, knew that Justin Herbert could have been a doctor if he wanted to be a doctor. I mean, he's an intelligent guy, and he's smart and good character. And you just knew that he would be okay being thrown into the fire. I have that same feeling about Bo Nix. I have that feeling to an extent about Caleb Williams. See, there was a maturity, even though Williams is younger, there was a maturity to Caleb Williams that I really like. Jaden Daniels, I don't see it. Penix, I do see it. Like Michael Penix, he had a bunch of starts. He had suffered through injuries. He had played at multiple schools. So I think in some ways the NFL, young quarterback in the NFL, using air quotes here, because some of these guys like Bo Nix are a little seasoned. The young quarterback in the NFL today, you know, in a lot of cases has been, I think, conditioned to deal with a professional environment. In that way, this whole question that we're talking about, you know, the college game versus the pro game, you know, there are some benefits there. All right, coming up, we're going to talk about some of the games this weekend on the NFL docket and the college docket. We'll get into the Ducks. Jason Eck, the Idaho coach, was on yesterday's show. He said something that really jumped out to me. I want you to hear it again about his game with Oregon. Is it possible Oregon, not Idaho, was responsible for the flat performance in week one? Everybody's saying, oh, now the tide has turned. Maybe Idaho had something to do with this. Maybe. But is it possible Oregon played a fundamental role in its vanilla approach to the game? We're going to talk about that coming up. Leave it here. You guys.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
All right, so Oregon had this performance that I can imagine Dan Lanning and the Ducks are just itching to get back on the field. You know they are. You know that they're ticked off about how they played in week one and all of the noise all week. Everybody, including me, saying, gosh, they didn't play that well. Oh, it's a bad win. Oh, it's it was a subpar performance. Oh, they're not the third best team in the country. Man, did they not look good for the weapons they had, for the recruiting classes they had, for the size they had in the offensive line. How could Idaho do this to them? Jason Eck, the coach at Idaho, joined us yesterday on the show, and I thought he did a really good job of kind of talking about their plan. They had a good plan, and they had some good players, but they don't have the kind of players that Ohio State has. But Eck said something during our interview. When I asked him, you know, about watching film of Oregon from last season and preparing for Oregon, I asked Eck if he saw anything in the game that surprised him. Was anything different? Here was his answer.
No, they definitely had some new wrinkles. You know, I think they played some different coverages on defense. You know, they had played a lot of what we call a bracket coverage last year. We expected more of that, and they mixed in some different coverages. You know, offensively, they had some new wrinkles. I mean, some of the things we saw, like, you know, jet sweep to number 15, Tez is a great player. You know, we expected that and repped that a lot during the week. You know, they had some you know, some new wrinkles in the passing game that he played to, you know, Gabriel's strengths. So I would say it was a probably a normal evolution. You know, they had new wrinkles. I think their core identity didn't change much from the year before. They probably played a little bit more, you know, a zero nose front where they lined up on a nose guard than they had played last year. You know, we thought they'd play us a little bit more in a four down line, you know, even look, especially when we were in 11 personnel, and they ended up playing us with more of that, you know, Oaky front or bare front, so that was a little different than we expected, but you know, it wasn't no drastic changes, I would say.
You got, there he is, Eck, Jason Eck, he's the coach at Idaho. Interesting to me, what jumped out at me, because I kind of listened to that, and I always like to go back and listen to the interviews a second time or a third time, and I just put the interview on, and I was kind of listening to it, and it was about 4 minutes into the interview, I asked him that question, and he gives his answer, and it didn't jump out to me at the time when I'm in like live interview mode. But a day later, what I heard there was Oregon on defense made some changes. They played a little different coverage. They played a little different front. But on offense, Eck, in fact, says they had practiced the fly sweep. They didn't see anything offensively that surprised them. And it left me not upset at Oregon's coaching staff at all, because I think Oregon's coaching staff probably thought they were just going to line up and they had better athletes and they were bigger and they were going to have no problem scoring 40 or 50. But I think Oregon's coaching staff went into that game and tried to show as little as possible and didn't do anything out of the ordinary. and tried to keep it as vanilla as possible. And in fact, you know, when you look at the, you know, the times on fourth down when Oregon tried to go for it and the fake punt, I think Oregon was trying to do some things to give other teams something to think about. You know, that's why you run a fake punt in the early part of the season against a team like Idaho, you know, because maybe you run something else or off of that later in the season when you need it. Like, you know, you're setting up a play for later and you want, you know, you want to give Ohio State a look at that, or you want to give Michigan State a look at that, or UCLA a look at that, or something to practice and think about. But I am more confident than ever that Oregon went into that game very vanilla, trying not to show anything, and realized that Idaho on the defensive line was better than they thought they were going to be and was really well coached. And Idaho went all out doing some things that Oregon wasn't prepared for and didn't practice against, and exploited some weaknesses at Oregon. And it's why I am more confident than ever that Oregon's going to come back this week, I think, and play a really good game. And, you know, I had picked Oregon to cover the 18.5 points, whatever that they were favored by. But I think Oregon's got a double-digit win in them this weekend against Boise State. And I'm basing it in part not just on the fact that I think Oregon's going to be angry and play angry, as they did coming out of the loss to Washington last season in the middle of the year. Oregon came out of that and played angry for a few weeks. Washington didn't. I don't know if people remember, after the Oregon win, Washington had a couple of flat performances. There's a psychology to this, too, that I think is fascinating when you see a team win a big game and then suffer a little bit of an emotional letdown, and very nearly got beat in a couple of games after that by inferior opponents. And Oregon, meanwhile, played angry in the wake of that game and looked really good going to Utah later in the season and winning at Utah in a way that nobody ever wins at Utah. And so I'm left kind of thinking, Judah, that Dan Lanning and Will Stein, as foolish as it may have been, thought they were just going to line up and pile drive Idaho. I keep calling them Utah. Idaho. But in the end, they weren't able to, because maybe Idaho's a little better than they thought they were going to be, and obviously prepared. Jason Eck said it. There was nothing there we weren't prepared for. We had practiced the fly sweep. They knew it was coming.
I think you make a savvy observation on that answer by Jason Eck. I love the Freudian slip with Utah and Idaho.
Keep doing it.
Isn't it a similar style, though? You know? I mean,
yes.
Hard-nosed play, their butts off, and don't take no for an answer. And you know, Oregon's had some success against Utah, but obviously they had to work for it with Idaho last year. I do have a question for you kind of on this theme, and it's really interesting because from my vantage point, if I'm a coach on the Oregon staff going into the year, every game plan that I have is informed some way by facing Ohio State October 12th. Every game plan that I have in the weeks leading up to it.
100%. 100%.
I'm installing, you know, a package of plays, the fake punt, whatever, trying to get into Ryan Day and Chip Kelly's mind and just to be planting seeds, give them more work to do, give them a left-handed thing here, you know, just be in there, because the whole season, at least in the regular year, hinges on October 12th. Do you think Oregon can still afford to do that based on the way that they played last week with that kind of quote-unquote vanilla offensive game plan? Can they still afford to kind of, you know, be thin with their game plan, or, you know, be a little bit... you know, they're trying to put in things that they're just toying with their food a little bit. Can they afford to do that against Boise, against Oregon State, against UCLA, against Sparty? Can they get away with that still?
I was watching at the end of the third quarter when the shout came on. I didn't like it, Judah. I didn't like that Oregon was jumping around and dancing.
That's
and
weird.
Guys who weren't in the game were celebrating and smiling. And I thought, you can't be happy with this performance. You can't, and I get it. It's, you know, kids are having fun. I understand that. I don't want to be an old man on my lawn, you know, shaking my fist at the clouds, but it's just like, I thought there's a time and place, and that's not the time and place. You haven't played well.
I kept thinking about Kirby Smart watching that after he just kicked Clemson up and down the field. He said, I wonder what my boy Dan's doing. Oh, look at that. 17-14 with Idaho with 9 minutes left, and they're dancing to shout.
Yeah, I didn't like it. I didn't like it at all.
That's not what a top team, elite program does there.
And it's generally, okay, there have been exceptions over the years. You know, we saw Troy Dye dancing and doing shout and whatever. But I tend to find that the players that are doing the biggest dance moves down at the end, towards the end of the bench, are generally players who aren't playing a lot. And I just, it doesn't strike me as like, that's not why you go to the University of Oregon to play football, is it? Like, to be on the sideline waving a towel and dancing to shout? I don't know. I'm not saying you should end the tradition. I think it's great that it plays and the fans have fun with it. But I would feel better about it if Oregon were up 45-7, you know, and I'd go, okay, go ahead and dance. Like, you've earned it. Because there's just a feel there. While Idaho was buckling up the chin straps, and Oregon was dancing to shout, and I was just like, "What are we doing here?"
Maybe that's a good metric. Like, you know, what's the shout meter at the end of the third quarter? What kind of game is this going to be? What kind of game do you think Boise and Oregon's going to be at the end of three quarters? Like, when they're shouting on Saturday night, is it going to be merited, or do you think there will be some work to do?
My barometer for Oregon is this: like, you know, you've watched Boise State run the ball so effectively in week one. And what I would equate as, simultaneously, it wasn't a great win. It's Georgia Southern. They give up, 40-plus points to that team. They win it by 11 or so points. 56-45. It's, to me, it wasn't a great win by Boise State either. And I left that Boise game thinking, how much Will Stein could do to that Boise State defense. There are some problems there. Simultaneously, the strength of Boise is the run game. And you know, I think if Oregon can get up two scores, three scores, and make this a game that Boise State has to throw the football in, turn them one-dimensional, I think you have a real opportunity for a big result. I oddly feel like the strength of Oregon's team right now, if I had to say which side of the ball it is, it's the defense, just based on the way the offensive line played and what Oregon showed. And I didn't think I would find myself in this position. I thought we would be talking about whether or not Tosh Lapoy can game plan against Chip Kelly on October 12th. And you're 100% right that everything that happens now has to do with October 12th. And it's not just Oregon. It's Ohio State as well. I have no doubt that Ohio State, Ryan Day, Chip Kelly, whatever, they're looking at Oregon's film. They're watching the Oregon game. They're checking the score. When their game's done, they are looking to see what happened with Oregon, because that is the big hurdle that is in the early part of the season for Ohio State and Oregon simultaneously. I couldn't help it when I saw that Idaho was in a one-score game and stopping Oregon on fourth and short. I immediately went, uh-oh, what's Ohio State going to do to them? What would Ohio State do to Idaho? I have a feeling it wouldn't have been a one-score game in the fourth quarter. And so Oregon's got some ground to gain this week, and my spidey senses are telling me, Jason Eck telling me, that Oregon played it very vanilla on offense in week one. I think they almost made a mistake. I think they should have opened it up a little more. I think they should have shown more of the game plan. But maybe they end up looking smart in the end, right? Because maybe they have held some things back here, and we're about to see Oregon do some things. But I don't know. It was part of the game plan, letting Idaho's defensive line disrupt your offensive line, because that's what happened on Saturday. All right, Big Splash is coming up. We've got What's on Tap coming up next hour. Punch It Audio ahead. Jeremiah Dickey, the athletic director at Boise State, will be joining us. We'll talk about the Beavers. Washington State and Oregon State, are they plotting for 2025 already? You better believe it. Scott Barnes, the AD at Oregon State, told me, we have a plan. What is the plan? I have some insight on that. I'll share it with you coming up.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Scott Barnes, the athletic director at Oregon State, did an interview with John Wilner and myself earlier this week, and it was rich stuff. I mean, he talked about Oregon State and Washington State, the Pac-12 being a Power 5 conference. He mentioned that several times. You could tell he's being really intentional about saying they are a Power 5 conference. They still believe they're a Power 5. They're going to fund like a Power 5. They're going to act like a Power 5. They're going to schedule like a Power 5. He said that numerous times. If you want to check out that interview, it's Canzano and Wilner is available on YouTube or on Apple Podcast as well. But I took a deeper dive on it today, and I took a look at the possibility of, you know, because Barnes in the interview, he said something interesting. He said, we have a plan. We have a plan. And not, you know, because I had said to him, you know, you're trying to buy yourself some time while you come up with a plan. He said, no, he corrected me. He says, we have a plan. And I reached out to Dave Brown, who is the scheduling guru at College Gridiron, Gridiron Football. He is the savant who does all of the scheduling as it pertains to, you know, the teams around the country that are looking at open dates. And, you know, there are a number of teams that right now have open dates for 2025, including Notre Dame and Duke and Miami and a whole bunch of others. And so Dave Brown will generally be busy trying to put these schedules together. Now, he worked for 28 years at ESPN. And for those of you who don't believe TV was running the bus, Dave Brown's job for 28 years at ESPN was to make games, literally make the match. He was the person behind the scenes that would look at the schedule, find an open date, and then go, hey, we'd like to see Oregon play LSU in a season opener. And we could put this game, you know, fill in the blank stadium. And, you know, we'll pay these teams X amount of dollars. But he was the guy who made those games. And because ESPN and others had the rights to so many games, Dave Brown was running around, you know, not just making big games, but he was making a lot of other matches as well because, you know, the ESPN wanted the best possible games. ESPN wanted matchups that were going to move the needle. And so they tried to encourage teams like Texas and Michigan playing this game tomorrow, or, you know, you can find other examples. You try to encourage teams to play these high-profile crossover games. Georgia-Clemson, great example. They find a venue. TV partner says we'll sweeten the pot by paying $4 million to the schools that play in it, and we're going to make a whole bunch of money on this. It's a revenue-generating machine. So Dave Brown's job was that at ESPN. So 28 years, he leaves, goes out on his own, and decides he's going to take all of his knowledge, all of his expertise, the database that he has, the connections he's made in scheduling, and he's going to do it himself. I admire it. It's entrepreneurial. He had a skill. He is uniquely qualified to do it. He saw an angle and said, I can charge schools to be part of my database, and I will help them all schedule. I'm doing it anyway at ESPN. So I reached out to Dave Brown, and he's helped me last September because I reached out when Oregon State and Washington State were essentially left as a two-team conference, and nobody knew if they could put a schedule together. And he assured me in last September, he said, they will put a schedule together. We can get it done. It's not ideal, but we can get it done. I'll find games. We can move things around. And lo and behold, this weekend is a wonderful example of that, like the schedule coming together. Because what do we have? You got Washington State hosting Texas Tech tomorrow. Game will be on Fox. The Red Raiders were originally supposed to play at Oregon this week, remember? Oregon State's going to San Diego State. That was a trip Washington State was supposed to make. And Boise State was supposed to play Oregon, but they weren't supposed to play Oregon until next week. They're 1 week off of where they should have been. They moved their game up, and they'll be at Autzen Stadium tomorrow to play the Ducks. This kind of flexibility and this game of musical chairs is exactly what is going to happen for Oregon State and Washington State as you move it forward. There is a creative scheduling strategy that is in play. And mind you, Dave Brown told me last September, he said, hey, we did it in the pandemic. We can put games together. And they did it. They got all these teams to move the games around, and what was the ultimate goal? The ultimate goal was getting a Civil War football game on the schedule for next week, week three of the season. Oregon did not have an open date that week. They were playing Boise State. So Oregon gives up Texas Tech. Texas Tech agrees to play Washington State. Washington State gives up San Diego State. Oregon State says, we'll play San Diego State. Boise State says, we'll move a week earlier. And there was a problem there, too, because Boise State, by moving a week earlier, caused a problem for San Diego State and Portland State. Portland State was supposed to play San Diego State September 21st. And instead, Portland State said, we will help Boise State, because Boise State had an opening now. We'll play them on September 21st to help fill the divot left by the move a week earlier. Broncos paid Portland State $425,000. San Diego State picked up the other $50,000. And guess what? Washington State's going to San Diego State later in the season as part of that agreement with the Mountain West to help make up for it. That's how it works. Dave Brown was in the middle of it at the time. He was shuffling the deck. I was asking him, hey, how is this going to come together? And he was saying, don't worry, I've done harder things. I would not want this for my job, because even writing it today, I was writing it at johnconzano.com. I had to walk away from it because I was like, okay, wait a minute. I don't want to confuse myself. They're doing what? But it's literally, you know, a spreadsheet in which, you know, these games are being moved all around. So it's easy to do with non-conference games the first month of the season. It gets harder later because the Big Ten, the SEC, the ACC, and others have scheduled out multiple years where they know that, you know, Oregon and Michigan are going to play, and Oregon and Ohio State are going to play, and Oregon and Penn State are going to play, and they know. So they've scheduled out for several years. So it becomes harder when it's not in the first month of the season, and therein lies the problem. Oregon State and Washington State have five games each on the schedule for next season. For Oregon State, it's Cal, Fresno State, Texas Tech on the road, tough one, at Oregon, tough one, and home against Houston. Washington State, a little easier, Idaho, San Diego State, North Texas, Virginia, Washington. And they'll also play each other, so there's six games each. So they have to come up with six games. Where are they going to find six games? And, oh, by the way, they can't be in the first month of the season because that's where those other games are scheduled. These are games that are going to have to take place in October and November. You got 6 weeks to do it. How do you do it? There's only one answer that I can see. It's the ACC. The ACC has buys worked into the season because they only play eight conference games. They have 17 teams. And you're potentially talking about adding 12 games. What else does the ACC need? It needs money. And so this is why I think it makes a lot of sense right now for the ACC and the Pac-12 to get together and go, okay, we're going to have you, Oregon State, you're going to play six ACC games. Washington State, you're going to play six ACC games. The CW is going to broadcast them. They will be 3 home games and 3 road games. So you have an ample number of games, and everybody's going to get paid, not just you. Not just you as the media partner, but the visiting teams are going to get paid too. And it's why I think a Pac-12 source on that Sunday night last weekend, when the deal was not reached with the Mountain West Conference, I had a Pac-12 source who told me, you know, I said, I think you can get better games than the Mountain West. And the person said back, I think we can get them cheaper. I think that was interesting. How do you get the ACC cheaper? Well, you get the CW involved. And that's why I kind of expect that that's what's going to happen. But tomorrow night's game at San Diego State is interesting to me. It's interesting because for a long time, the Pac-12 said, we don't need San Diego. We've already got Southern California. We've got USC. We've got UCLA. We don't need San Diego State. Well, that's gone now. The Big Ten can say that. I don't see the ACC or the Big 12 interested, or certainly not the SEC, interested in San Diego State right now. It's just a reach. It would be so far geographically. It would be such a weird addition. You know, Stanford and Cal come to mind with the ACC, but still, it's a weird, it would be a strange addition to those conferences. But I got to think that if Oregon State, Washington State are facing a potential rebuild, that San Diego State would be like that's my number one call. You get back into Southern California. Is there enough there, though? We shall see. If you want to read more about it, you want to go down that rabbit hole, you can go to johnconzano.com. I wrote all about it. Scott Barnes was very, very interesting. And I think tipping his hand a little bit and selling a little hope to the fan base. He also predicted that Chip Kelly's vision for college football, football splitting away from the Olympic sports, will come true. Scott Barnes saying that he believed that it was the wheels were already in motion for college football to be a division of 50 to 60 teams and split away and do its own thing, and Olympic sports going back to more regionalized conferences. Maybe he's wishing and hoping, but, you know, you said it, I said it, we heard Chip Kelly, you know, utter it. It just makes more sense to have football split away and do its own thing. Coming up, Boise State Athletic Director Jeremiah Dickey. We'll talk to him about his school, his vision, the game tomorrow against Oregon. What does it mean for the Broncos? All of that ahead.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
Well, we got football coming out of our ears this weekend. NFL, college football, games here, games there, streaming games, games in Brazil, games at Autzen Stadium, another at San Diego State. That game over in Pullman is interesting. Mike Leach going into the Hall of Fame. Our next guest is the athletic director at Boise State, Jeremiah Dickey, who is formerly at Baylor University. I want to talk to him about his vision for Boise State, the Mountain West, what this game means, what it's like to be working in this era of football. He's made a bunch of hires, including Spencer Danielson, who's now the football coach. Is this what he thought he was getting into? Is it really that way for any of us, though? I was talking about that today with somebody. Jeremiah Dickey, Boise State Athletic Director, joining us now. Where are you right now? Set the scene for us.
I'm out in front of the Graduate Hotel on the street, so I apologize for the cars. I was trying to find better service so I could jump on with you guys. I appreciate you guys having me on.
I love that. I love the flavor of that. Is that the team hotel? And if so, what is that like to be with the team on a road trip like this?
Oh, there's nothing like it. It's one of the benefits of not just being the athletic director, but being in this industry and getting to travel with the guys and just connecting. You know, normally I don't always get to see them during the day, and so to travel with them and hang out with them in the lobby, and it's part of, you know, our culture, and it takes a team. And so I know our support staff and coaches and the families that are here, everyone appreciates it. It's exciting. You work all year for these moments, and so we're excited.
I know you have three kids. Is it harder to travel as a family with three kids going through TSA, or harder to travel with 80 football players on a road game?
Oh, we're so spoiled, guys. Like, we charter everywhere, and, you know, my kids now are spoiled that when we actually have to fly Southwest, they're like, Dad, where's the food, and why are they checking me? And, you know, so they live a very fortunate life. But, yeah, it's much easier with the team.
I was talking in the last hour about all the dominoes and the musical chairs that has to happen. You know, you guys, I think, I don't want to say you did a favor, but you did a kind thing, I think, by being open to moving your game that was originally supposed to be in week three to week two. That gave Oregon a chance to, you know, play the Civil War game. You know, I know you had a future game with Oregon coming there that probably was difficult to give up, but give us an idea. Take us behind the curtain. When all that stuff's going on, and you got the scheduling guru, Dave Brown, probably on speed dial, what is that like? What is that like in an athletic department?
Well, one, I appreciate you giving Dave a shout out. He doesn't get nearly enough credit. I'm hopeful he has someone behind him who's going to take the reins when he exits, because he's outstanding. But, you know, guys, it's business. This is business. And I don't take it personally. You know, I appreciated Oregon when they called, and I understood what they were navigating. And, you know, this is just part of our industry right now. Everything's extremely chaotic. It's uncomfortable. You know, I'm not sure it's exactly what, you know, I thought it would be, you know, as I worked to be an AD over the last 18 plus years. But, you know, you get to the chair, and my job as the leader is to navigate and play the hand we've been dealt and do it to the best of my ability. And I'm really grateful because, you know, the other option was losing this game. And yeah. I think this is a great game. We have a ton of fans here. We have a ton of Ducks in Boise and in Idaho. This is a great game. And so I'm grateful that they, you know, we still have the opportunity to play it.
You guys have a home schedule this season. I think your fans are excited about you. You get Oregon State and Washington State both there. You know, you're going on the road in this Oregon game that is a big game. A lot of people are picking your program, Jeremiah, to be the group of five representative in the playoff. And I think they're watching to see how you guys perform this week in particular. You know, this has to be, at least for the short term, feeling good to you that there's some direction and traction and you're part of it.
For sure. You know, I inherited an unbelievable brand. My job is to elevate it. And, you know, what we've been able to do the last couple of years is we continue to invest into our program and continue to build on, you know, the blue and everything Boise State's been about for the last 26 years. Yeah, it's exciting. And the fact that we have a seat at the CFP table. You know, you're playing for more than a bowl game, and hope is powerful. And when you can tell that story and create momentum around it and have a team behind you that's pulling the rope in the same direction, you can do amazing things. We're out to do epic, and there are no guarantees. You know, you gotta be the best, you gotta beat the best. And, you know, I know we have a rough road ahead of us. We have a great schedule, you know, a challenging schedule, but I wouldn't want it any other way. That's why I'm at Boise State. I want to compete, and we have a high level of competitive excellence that is our standard, and now we have opportunities to go out and prove it.
I'm thinking about the scheduling alliance with the Pac-12. You guys, obviously, part of that this season. Why did that appeal to you? And, you know, as you turn and talk to your university president, obviously there's some revenue in it, but it looks like you got some home games for your home schedule that add a little bit of spice to the home schedule.
Yeah, I mean, one, I'm extremely empathetic for what Oregon State and Washington State have gone through, continue to go through. I don't think any AD is overly excited about what's happened in our industry and realignment. But once again, you play the hand you've been dealt, and we were presented an opportunity, or our conference was, that I think fits well in terms of who we are as a conference, and especially, you know, selfishly, when I look at Boise and the number of, I said Ducks earlier, but the number of Cougs and you know, Beavers, and I mean, it makes a difference. My job is to create momentum and drive revenue, you know, so I can reinvest back into our department. And we have an expectation of 6-game, 6 sellouts. And when you're playing Oregon State at home and Washington State at home, it helps. And so, you know, I already had Oregon State scheduled. So that helped us, and you know, and it sets up now that we have this, you know, potential seat of the Group of Five does at the CFP table. So I'm grateful for it. I understand there are a lot of moving pieces to it, and you know, I appreciate Gloria and everything she's done, and I know Teresa and the Pac-12 have their own challenges, and you know, we'll see what happens.
What do you think happens 5 years, 10 years from now, as you look at college athletics? Are football and the Olympic sports together, or is there going to be a division in your mind? You know, I'm not going to hold you to this, but where do you kind of see it? Where do you see it happening?
I think it's within 5 years. I do think college football, and it's just my opinion, I think college football breaks away. And then I believe there could be another break after that, you know, and not necessarily everyone assumes it's SEC and Big Ten. I think it could be a subset of those, but depends on how many they want to add. And I do think that's coming. It's not if, you know, but when. And I do believe we're going to get to collective bargaining. You know, we're living insanity. And, you know, at this point, I just don't especially with yesterday in the House hearing, and I just don't see another path forward. And so, but I'm hopeful, you know, there's always, even in chaos, that's when you have the most opportunity. And for a place like Boise State, for us to position ourselves to continue to create momentum, continue to drive that competitive excellence that I inherited, that gives hope. And I said it earlier, hope is powerful, and we're going to continue to play the stand to the best of our ability.
Give me an idea, you know, as you try to, everyone's trying to position themselves. You have a great brand. Boise State has mattered and has been around major college football, and I think gave us the first glimpse years ago with the Statue of Liberty of what a team from the Group of Five could do and how those teams belong. The Utah, Boise State, some just great examples of excellence. But what can you do that's in your control now that positions you for what happens in 5 or 10 years?
Well, one, having that seat at the table helps. You know, we have to go out and handle our business, and that's, you know, easier said than done. You know, we've always had a bullseye on our back, and we have to continue to be competitive. And my job is to continue to invest back into these student athletes and our coaches and our collective department. But that presents the opportunities as we look ahead. And, you know, my opinion earlier of football is going to break away. You know, I know where we're currently at, and, you know, in terms of the 134, and you know, I would say that we're one of the top five Group of Five teams, and we're right on the outside looking in. And my job, my goal is to put us in a position that when that break occurs, and you know, that we have a chance, and you know, and we'll see. There's so many moving parts to this. Every day this industry changes, and I'm getting more comfortable being uncomfortable, you know, and you know, time is going to tell, but you know, I know what we're doing is working, and you know, and I'm grateful. People are stepping up. Bronco Nation is supportive, and it's always what's next for us. We're not going to cry over the spilled milk. We're going to go figure out how to buy a new cow.
Jeremiah Dickey with us, Boise State Athletic Director. The talk in the state of Oregon this week has been all about Oregon maybe not looking that great against Idaho. What are people in Boise talking about all week?
I honestly, once the season starts, I don't pay attention too much. You know, we operate with a 1-0 mentality, and it's always what's next, as I said. And I heard, you know, everyone, I didn't get to catch the game. We were flying back from the East Coast, but it's the first game of the season. Oregon's a great team, obviously in the top 10, and they should be probably ranked higher than that. You know, that first game, you're getting the cobwebs out. You know, you're trying to figure out what works, and you're not unloading or you know, your full playbook, because you know, they got a lot of great teams ahead of them. And you know, so I don't look too much into, you know, how we played, how they played. What I would expect is both teams are going to be prepared for tomorrow, and both are going to be much improved from the week before. And you know, and I'm excited for it. You know, this is my first game, you know, here in person, and so, you know, I'm really looking forward to seeing the crowd. I've heard great things about their game experience, and you know, I'm excited.
Been some super memorable games in this series, and yet Boise leads it 3-0. You know, some people reminding me of that all week long. Jeremiah, the coach, you hire Spencer Danielson, you promote him. I think your offensive coordinator is gifted. You know, tell me what you saw in Spencer that made you say, "I'm going to hand you the keys."
You know, it was his authenticity. You know, anytime you name an interim, and I was flying around the country, you know, interviewing candidates and going through a process, but we still had games to play. And, you know, to see him, you know, embrace that challenge and the opportunity he had in front of him. And he didn't do it because he was trying to play himself into a job. He was doing it because that was the right thing to do for that team. You know, I think this was would have been the first freshman class that had gone through Boise State that did not win a Mountain West championship. And to have less than 1% chance to do that, and I was involved in a lot of those team meetings, and to hear how he spoke to them, and understanding that all those coaches, there was not a guarantee that they would be on staff. At that point, Spencer didn't even know if he would be. But he put all that aside for the sake of the team, and he asked everyone else to do the same, and they did. And for me as an athletic director, that's what I'm looking for. You know, that's what a leader is. You know, it wasn't about him at that moment. It was about the team. It was about us and how we served those student athletes, and especially that senior class. And in that, he just, through the process, he just continued to rise. And to see how our kids responded to him, I mean, they would run it through a wall for him. And that doesn't mean you're going to win every game and whatever else, but, you know, when you're, you know, and I always think about this, like, right now it's tough. This is a tough industry. You know, there's a reason a lot of people are getting out, and you know, but it fires me up. And when you think about when the going gets tough and who you want in your foxhole with you, you want someone like that, that isn't going to be doing what's best for him. He's doing what's best for us. And you know, when you don't care who gets credit, it's amazing what you can accomplish. And that's the type of person he is. And I very much align with that. And you know, him and I are both out to do epic.
We're talking to Jeremiah Dickey. He is the athletic director at Boise State. The Broncos will be at Autzen Stadium tomorrow, Oregon, Boise State, big football game. All right, what are you going to do? What are you going to do in Eugene between maybe tonight, tomorrow morning? How do you spend your time?
So after this call, I'm going to go for a run. I have a routine. You know, I'm a creature of habit, so I'm going to go for a run. And then we have a bunch of donors with us and a lot of people who are coming up today and tomorrow, and so I'm going to spend a lot of time with donors, always fundraising. You know, and then I'm going to have lunch tomorrow with Jimmy Sandin for the Ducks.
Yes.
Good friend and known him a long time and looking forward to seeing him. And then get ready for the game. I'm usually with the team. Honestly, the away games are the only time I get to watch the game. Usually when we're at home, I'm up in the suites, I'm fundraising. And, you know, so on the road, I try to take some time and spend some time with the coaches, the staff, the kids. And I try to enjoy the game. You know, it's the bonus of the muck that most ADs are probably having to navigate. It's nice on a Saturday just to watch and appreciate, you know, your student athlete.
Now, where are you gonna run? Because you could run up to Prees Rocks, the spot up on the hill there where Steve Prefontaine had the accident, and I know a lot of runners will run up to that spot, that monument, to try to pay homage, you know. Are you just going to run through the streets? What are you going to do?
I'm not sure yet. Someone just handed me this runner's map, Tracktown USA.
Yeah.
And I'm going to pick something close to the hotel, and I'm not, you know, I don't want to oversell it. Like, I'll get 2 or 3 miles in and just get a sweat going and kind of clear my head and come back, get ready for dinner tonight, and get ready for the game tomorrow.
I love it. All right, have a good run. Make sure you hydrate. I appreciate you joining us. Jeremiah Dickey, Boise State. Thanks, man.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. Go Broncos.
All right, there he goes. Boise State, Oregon. Always memorable, aren't they? Well, do you remember LeGarrette Blount, Byron Haupt? What was the aftermath of that like, I wonder? What was the ride back to the airport, the flight home, the scene in the locker room? I remember they kept showing it. I was there that night in Boise. They kept showing it on the big screen over and over and over again. We got a treat coming up in the next segment. As you know, Nick Cody called in the other day, former Oregon Duck offensive lineman. And you know, when he got off the show, he texted me and he said, "You didn't even ask me what it was like to be in the locker room and on the bus and what that scene was like." He said it was insane. He's going to join us real quick. He's going to call in the next segment. Says he has something to say about the aftermath of that punch and what it was like. I think it'll be worth a few minutes of radio, so stick around.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Well, I remember it like it was yesterday. I had my column written. I was on deadline. I'm in what is now Albertson Stadium, but is the home field of Boise State. And game is ending, and just about to go down to the field when LeGarrette Blount threw the punch. Byron Haupt got decked, and then it was a wild aftermath. I refiled and rewrote my column in 18 minutes. I watched the scene. I talked to people involved, but I wasn't in the locker room. I wasn't on the bus to the airport
I wasn't on the team plane. Who was? Well, Nick Cody, former University of Oregon offensive lineman. He was there, and he joins us now to talk about it. I'm dying to know, and we're going to go slow here, Nicky, but I'm dying to know that scene in the aftermath of the game. Where were you when the punch was thrown? Let's start there. You're on the field. What's happening?
Yeah, first and foremost, thanks for having me on to let me relive this nightmare, John. I appreciate it.
You bet.
At least get it out of the system before the game tomorrow night. I think some interesting context that's important before is that 2009 game is not only Chip's first game as the head coach, but it's my first game as an actual member of the travel roster. I had redshirted in 2008, back when a redshirt year actually meant you didn't get to see the field at all. So all of the 2008 season, I was on the sidelines in just a jersey, no pads. So this is my first time padding up on the road, John. So I wasn't necessarily sure what to expect. And especially with the blue field, the Boise crowd, the energy for an early, I believe it was a Thursday night game, but one of those preseason games where you're kind of the only thing on TV. Everybody's watching on ESPN. And I remember at the end of the game, particularly because Boise had some kids from the state of Washington that were either, you know, in my recruiting class or I'd played against, or, you know, even a couple of coaches that kind of reached out and recruited me. You're always thinking at the end of the game, like, who do I want to go say kudos to, give a high five, a handshake? And I just remember being about 20, 30 yards away from the chaos when it happened. And just ultimately, I think overall, everything that happened in the aftermath, the replaying of it on the scoreboard, fans trying to rush down after seeing it to let us know how they felt about it. All that was definitely like you're able to go back and view that. You can see the footage. Everybody can kind of imagine what that experience is like. But I think what most people don't know is that going back into the locker room, everybody's kind of, you know, upset, trying to figure out how do we process this. And the defense is in a tiny wrestling room, and the offense is in a tiny high school-sized locker room, and there's not enough benches for everybody to sit. And I remember Chip comes in and just says, hey, everybody, shut up. We're not going to be able to fix this right now. We're not going to be able to do anything about it. Get your stuff off. Get showered. Let's get on the buses and get home, and we'll figure it out. And I think from that moment on, everybody zipped it. We all got our stuff together. I think the most difficult part from that point on was actually getting to the bus, because Boise fans were waiting there with the barricades and everything, like hoping to get some kind of shout out to our bus, you know, sitting there pounding on the barricades, just hoping for any piece of flesh they could get. But I remember guys hoping to get to see their parents after the game that, you know, it was like, I remember texting my mom like, yeah, just get out of here. I'll call you tomorrow. And overall,
were you scared? Were you scared, Nick? Wait, Nick, was there a real fear factor that the Boise fans were going to get to the players?
There's a moment when we're going back into the locker rooms, especially because of where the locker rooms are located, you kind of have to go under the scoreboard that they've just been replaying this on again and again. And you can see people from the upper levels rushing down the stairs and not rushing to exit. They were trying to get it. I think everybody, the staff there at Boise, did great. I think most fans were, you know, great, but it reminded me a lot of, you know, that 2018 Stanford game in Austin, where you just have a couple of fans that go really, really far and make that experience a lot more negative for everybody.
Nick Cody is with us, former Oregon offensive lineman. He was there the night to LeGarrette Blount threw the punch at Boise. Okay, so Chip says, shut up, and begins to talk. Does it go dead silent other than Chip Kelly's voice?
Pretty much, and then Chip really didn't say much either. I mean, what was there to say? We came out, and offensively, we just weren't productive. Defensively, you know, I think we played a hard game, but ultimately didn't do enough to stop Boise and didn't get anything going for ourselves. So, it was a huge kind of a pivot moment of, okay, guys, we put the work in. We know how good we potentially are. It just took us, I think, a couple games to really figure out, really until that Cal game that year, to figure out what we had going and how to get it all on the same track.
The bus ride to the airport and the flight, how were they amid all of that? And did you see LeGarrette at the time? Because I know
Coach Frost, Scott Frost, kind of helped him off the field. It was like watching a guy push a refrigerator across a gymnasium floor. But it was, you know, it was quite a scene because LeGarrette was fighting back as well.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, Scott Frost, for being a wide receiver coach at the time, probably one of the most stacked wide receiver coaches in college football at the time. So he could handle his. But, yeah, I mean, I don't remember too much. I'm sure he was monitored and secure. But I remember probably the quietest. I mean, we, you know, there's a lot of quiet bus rides in college football, but they're usually to the game and not leaving them. But that was one of the quieter ones. And the flight home, not fun. But, you know, there's worse places to fly out of than Boise to get back to Eugene. So it was a learning experience, and it definitely had its moments of fear. I remember, like, yeah, the scene outside the back of the locker room, getting on the bus and just thinking, like, all right, normally just your fans are back here. But there were a lot of bloodthirsty Boise fans, you know, pounding on the barricades, hoping to get to the buses, just waiting there to make a ruckus. And, yeah, just the way the whole situation escalated so much more. For just one punch instead of, you know, you see some of those brawls in college football. It was not one of those. You know, I think it got settled pretty fast, but it was impactful. It was seemingly all anyone remembers from that game besides possibly Oregon, you know, not underperforming and wearing all white. That's usually the thing people ask me about that game most.
You know what I noticed that day is it was Chip's first game as the head coach. Mike Bellotti, you know, at halftime, comes down from the box and is on the sideline like he's trying to help Chip coach. Do you remember Bellotti being around in that week? Or, you know, he didn't. It wasn't like he stood next to Chip, but you could see it was like the former coach going, I got to help this guy. We can't get a first down.
Yeah, I think I was so dialed into the game that I don't know at what point he wasn't there. I mean, I was, you know, sitting there hoping to get my first live game reps at some point. You know, had we gotten, you know, some more than what, probably like 45 offensive snaps, I probably would have got my first opportunity. But I was dialed in trying to see whatever I could do from the sideline to either, you know, help the offensive linemen that are out there understand why, you know, we aren't working to the right point calls with the receivers. Those kinds of things I was trying to point out more than I was, you know, paying attention to what Coach Kelly was doing. You know, when you're in that position group, that's kind of where your focus is, and offensive line especially, you know, you're trying to work with, you know, 5 to 8 other guys that, you know, all need to be able to look at a defense and see the exact same thing and how to attack it the same way.
What was LeGarrette like as a teammate?
Yeah, I mean, I've got respect for all my teammates, and he's definitely one of the people that had one of the biggest growth curves. I know he was there technically in my recruiting class, so he was there when I was freshman and got to see him really come in, step up, and just do big things. And then I think there was a huge, after the 2008 season, there was kind of, especially after how well he performed in the Holiday Bowl, there was a lot of expectations on him that, you know, I think that off season, I don't know if the work was quite there for what his expectations were. And I always remember that being like a really vital thing in terms of him coming back and Coach Kelly implementing a plan, because it felt like everybody in the media was saying, hey, Coach either needs to make a statement and get rid of him or, you know, bring him back on the team, support the guy. And Chip really just wasn't going to be told to do either. And I know he reached out to Coach Dungy and created a plan to work towards getting back on the field. And he said the best thing for LeGarrette really right now is to be with this team and to not play football, but to be with us and to focus on the conditioning and the academics. And once he proved to himself and his teammates that he was able to come back later in that season for the Civil War game, he was. And I think that was a huge part of his growth and why he was able to be such a successful NFL player for so many different teams.
All right, Nick Cody, Boise State, your team's never beat them. What is it about the Broncos?
Yeah, I think the ideologies of what, like, fans perceive of these teams tends to go into it when you get to this week. But I think at the end of the day, I mean, these schools are very similar on different paths. I feel like Boise, you know, really had that boom with the Plansky years and, you know, the Fiesta Bowls and the success and the championships, and had a little bit of a dip that they're starting to come out of now. And I feel like that's, you know, kind of a very similar pathway to what Oregon's been doing, power 4 level, power 5 level. within the past decade. So I just think there's a lot of similarities. I always remember back to thinking, you know, Coach Peterson, originally at Dots. You know, there's always just been those little connections there. And I definitely look at Boise as somebody that's always going to be one of those teams that is going to be challenging every time they play Oregon, because that's a Super Bowl for a team like that. You get to play with the Oregons, the Oklahomas, the Alabamas, whoever, you're going to step up and you're going to give it your A game.
Nick Cody, I appreciate you, man. You have a good weekend.
Thank you. You too, John. Go Ducks.
There he is. The aftermath. Judah, I was there. LeGarrette wasn't happy. I remember Scott Frost. He pretty much had him in a full Nelson as he was trying to remove him from the stadium. And he went right out, as Nick Cody said, under that scoreboard into the tunnel. And the Boise fans were mad. They were gathered around the mouth of the tunnel. I then turned my focus to, I have to rewrite this if I want to get this into the paper. And, oh, I have 18 minutes. Ken Goh, my colleague at the paper, was beside me, like, going, you're never going to make it. And I rewrote that column and filed it. And then the subsequent fallout was Chip Kelly in this program. Like, you know, you didn't know for a few weeks if this was going to work out. And ultimately, it ends up being one of the great success stories in the story of Oregon football. Chip Kelly takes over the program, elevates it. Then he, of course, hands it off to Markel Fritch, who kind of goes sideways with it, but got to the title game. And then it becomes Willie Taggart, Mario Cristobal, Dan Lanning. You know, that chapter and that night, that first night of Chip Kelly's first game and LeGarrette Blount throwing the punch, it's part of the story.
It's kind of surreal to think about that game still, because I remember watching that game and obviously rooting for the Ducks at the time and listening to your radio show the Monday after. Because, you know, your radio show was pretty fresh on the scene at the time, too. And yeah, that's where everybody went to congregate to hear what you were going to say, your take on it. And I remember being one of those. That was going into my high school senior year. And
good Lord, I'm old.
Sorry about that. The Beavers went there a couple years later with Mike Riley and lost as well as a ranked-on-ranked team at Boise. And that was kind of when we're like, okay, the Blue Turf, Pacific Northwest teams just don't win there except for Boise State. And I remember the 08 game with Boise State as well, that more high-scoring game. And I was like, what? The Ducks lost to Boise? And you're the Vegas Bowl, and you look up, you're 0-3 against Boise State. So it's a really fascinating series, and you got so much respect for Boise. But that was a surreal time when LeGarrette Blount, who I didn't know much about, right? I mean, he was new on the scene in Oregon as well, behaves like that. I think, you know, we were all kind of, like, embarrassed and also just like, yeah, the loss hurt enough. We didn't need another black eye, pardon the pun.
It was alarming. Oregon did not have a first down at halftime. Okay? No first downs. It ended up with 6 in the game. Ended up 1-for-10 on third down in the game, 0-for-2 on fourth down in the game. You know, couldn't get a first down. Jeremiah Masoli couldn't throw the ball. He's 14 of 27. He averaged about 4.5 yards an attempt. Oregon averaged less than 2 yards per rush in the game.
Jeez.
It was a knockout in every sense for Boise State. It was 19-8. That was the final score, but it was worse than that. Now, you look back and you go, Kellen Moore was at quarterback for Boise State. I was a good player. And you look back at Boise State's roster, and lo and behold, Boise State had some players who went on and played in the NFL. In this era of name, image, likeness in the transfer portal, I wonder how much those group of five teams will have, you know, an ample opportunity to compete and stick around. And one of the big questions for this year's college football playoff is going to be, all right, the group of five team that makes the playoff, likely the 12 seed, how do they fare against the 5 seed? You know, and if they don't fare well, if it's a Liberty situation from a year ago, I do expect the Big Ten and the SEC to go, that shouldn't be an automatic berth. Only if they're ranked in the top 12 should they get an at-large berth. I expect that will be the narrative if that group of five champion is not competitive. Here comes the first opportunity we have this season anywhere to see a good G5 team or people think is a contender for that berth play a team that has been penciled in lightly now with the college football playoff. This very well could be the 5-12 game in the playoff. Oregon as the runner-up in the Big Ten. Boise State as the highest-ranked group of five team. This could be the game. And so I am very interested to see if this is going to be Boise State at Autzen Stadium in week two, and then Boise State coming back, because remember, it'll be a home game for the five seed for a rematch later this season. So let's see how these teams play each other. If Boise can hang around, if Boise can be in this game, if Boise can win this game, you know, it might say something about the playoff itself. So I am really fascinated to see how it goes. All right, what's on tap for the weekend coming up? Anna's got the 5 at 5. Leave it here.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Tom Brady's going to get his first game as a broadcaster. He's excited.
Well, I've reached out to all the different people that I've met over the years of in media and sports, and got their take on kind of what the job entailed, and then ultimately how the preparation goes during the week, and then how do you be really good when you come on air. And I've had a lot of time, I think, over the course of my career in interviews, production meetings, and being on camera.
Yeah.
That hopefully it's not too far from what I've already experienced, knowing that there's going to be a lot of things that are new to this. So I think the most exciting part for me is there's more of a structure to my life, which I've always enjoyed.
There it is. Structure to his life. Tom Brady will get his first opportunity in the broadcast booth. We'll see how he does it. It brings us to what's on tap for the weekend.
Now. It's time for What's on Tap and What's on TV at the Independent on the BFT.
Well, coming up tonight on Peacock, you got an NFL football game being played in Brazil, of all places. Do we really need this? I think it's probably fun for them, but it'll be Green Bay, Philadelphia, 5:15. Coming up a half an hour from now on Peacock. Not the only game of the weekend on Peacock, but that's where the weekend starts. Moving along to what we're going to see later in the weekend. 9 a.m. Saturday on Fox. It'll be Texas at Michigan. Check that out. Cal and Auburn at 12:30 on ESPN2. Baylor, Utah. Looking forward to that one. 12:30 on Fox Saturday. Eastern Michigan at Washington. Blacked out on the Big Ten Network if you are a Comcast subscriber, but if you can get the Big Ten Network, you're going to see Eastern Michigan, Washington, 12:30 on Saturday. Colorado, Nebraska at 4:30 Saturday on NBC. The other Peacock game, Boise State at Oregon, 7 o'clock on Peacock. So if you get the NFL game streaming tonight, you'll get Boise State, Oregon also streaming. Texas Tech plays Washington State on the road, 7 o'clock on Fox, completing Fox's, a triple header. Northern Arizona at Arizona at 7 o'clock on ESPN+. Oregon State, San Diego State, 7:30 on CBS Sportsnet. Mississippi State at Arizona State, 7:30 on ESPN. And Utah State, USC, 8 o'clock, Big Ten Network. People in Southern California now getting a taste of that Comcast business. How do you think Brady's going to be, Judah? Thumbs up, thumbs down on Brady.
Yeah, I'm thumbs up. And I totally get your argument on, you know, he's taken over Greg Olson's role and Greg didn't deserve that. I agree with that, actually. I think Greg Olson's hard done by. I just think Tom he's a prep addict. And I think he's going to to prep for this and really do a great job with it. It might be a little bit bumpy first one out of the gate, but long term, I think Brady's going to end up being one of the best analysts we have in the game, and he's going to leave Romo in his dust. And isn't that amazing? We're talking about that, like comparing analysts. Like, that's where we are as media consumers now. Is like, that's an actual topic. I'm interested in it. Maybe not everybody is, but I love kind of comparing my analysts and what they're bringing to the table.
I get on an airplane. I'm judging the pilot on the landing and the takeoff.
Yeah.
So I'm going to judge Tom Brady on his performance, and I am skeptical that he's going to be good. I think it'll be really interesting to see what position they put him in and whether or not he sounds prepared and interesting. I think it's a very different thing than what he's been doing successfully at a high level. And I think people will very quickly lose patience for him if he's not very good. Ari Wasserman on 3 Sports thinks Oregon's going to bounce back in a big way against Boise State. Here's what he said.
This is one of those games that you talk about in July, right? Like, what is Oregon going to be? And are they going to run into trouble week 2 when they face Boise? Like, so I have a hard time with the week 1 overreactions in the negative. I think that Oregon is still unquestionably one of the top 5 teams in the country. I think they have too much firepower to be a team that struggles week in and week out to score. Like, I like Oregon here to bounce back in a big way.
There he is, predicting the bounce back. I have it as a bounce back as well. But I think it's more about Idaho might have been decent, and Oregon was too vanilla, and Dan Lanning and the Ducks are going to be angry. Judah, do you see a bounce back performance for Oregon?
I think they win pretty comfortably. I think Boise keeps it within 19 points, though. I just want to see 2 things. 1, explosive plays, and 2, can the offensive line give up a 1 sack or fewer, right? And that's all I'm really kind of looking at, because, John, I don't know how good the offensive line truly is, even though I want to believe it's good. It's always good, but, you know, they lost a lot.
Georgia Southern got 45. Yeah. Oregon should get 70. Like, this should be a very easy offensive game for Will Stein, so I want to see that. Agree with you on the big plays. Just thought it was weird that Oregon had no plays over 30 yards against a Big Sky opponent last week. Very few pass plays above 10 yards. I think they had 3, and they only had 2 running plays that were more than 10 yards. And so I think it was kind of a dismal offensive performance, looking for a nice bounce back from the offense. So I do agree with Wasserman. Meanwhile, you've got Oregon State on the road at San Diego State. We talked to Jaden Robinson yesterday about this. He talked about the closeness of the team and getting ready for San Diego State.
I think it's all there. You know, I think the big test is going to be going on the road this week, how we handle that, you know, bringing our own energy, how we come out, how we start out the gate. You know, I think that's going to be the biggest thing. But I think, you know, we're all one right now. I think, you know, everybody's making plays. Everybody's happy for each other. Making plays, you know, nobody's too concerned about, oh, I should be playing this, oh, I should be playing that. You know, I think, you know, everybody on the team is selfless right now. You know, I think everybody's bought into what we got going on this season and what we're trying to accomplish.
All right, you find out a lot about yourself as a team when you go on the road. And Oregon State's going on the road here. To what, you know, Snapdragon Stadium, San Diego State, that's normally a really tough matchup. But Sean Lewis is in a rebuild. San Diego State is not what they are at their best. So I do think it's you know, the bar is raised for Oregon State, but I don't think it's outside of their reach. I have the Beavers winning. I think they win by a touchdown. I think the spread was 4, started at 4, went to 5.5. I do think they're going to cover. How about you?
I think so, too. It's kind of like a 24-13 type of game to me. You know, I'm going to watch the Beaver defense. Can they just put the clamps on a Sean Lewis offense that's going to be pace and energy and all this stuff? They want to try to run the ball as well. But the Beaver defense should be a really good unit all season long again. And they're going to be without Chisholm, I think. He had the targeting last week, and so he'll have to miss the first half of this game at linebacker. But outside of that, I mean, I think Oregon State defensively should have its way. And fumbles, turnovers. You know, Jam fumbled on the opening drive last week. Can Javonte McCoy take care of the football? Those types of things. If Oregon State plays a clean game, they win this in kind of boring fashion. But if they don't, then I think it could be hairy in the fourth quarter.
I keep an eye on it. In Oregon State's case, a win is a win is a win this season. I think it's a very different calculus from what Oregon is going to be, you know, the standard Oregon's going to be held to. And I will have Duck fans, no doubt, throughout the course of the season will say, hey, you're so much harder on Oregon than you are with Oregon State. Well, hell, the expectations at Oregon are about getting to the Final Four and setting Dan Lanning and the program up for winning a national championship? You know, does it come this year? Does it come in 2 years? You need to see the trajectory improve. It was a 10-win first season. It was better last season. Needs to be better this season. And I kind of set the bar at getting to the four, getting to that final four, making a national semifinal. And so the expectations for Oregon are going to be a little nitpicky. And it's going to be framed against October 12th. And can they compete against Ohio State? And can they be one of the two best teams in the Big Ten this season? Because that's the other thing that no one's talking about. Like, nobody's saying this. But I kind of think October 12th will be this big game, big stage, probably the largest crowd to ever see a football game in the state of Oregon. And then October 13th, the narrative will be, if Oregon wins, they're in the driver's seat. Can they sustain? Can they avoid tripping and falling? Can they get to the conference championship game and then do it again, potentially against Ohio State? But if they lose the game, the narrative is, hey, this playoff is very forgiving. You can still be in the top four, even though you lost that game. And guess what? You could probably lose another game and still get into the playoff. So it's going to be about staying healthy, improving, and that's where good coaching comes in. And so I think it'll be really interesting to kind of look at, you know, October 12th being set up as this end-all, be-all game. It's not. It's just like a pit stop on the way to somewhere else. And if you're an Oregon fan, yes, you want to see your team win that game. But more importantly, you want to see your team be better than they were on October 12th, come late November, early December, conference championship game, and then the playoff beginning. So I didn't see that from Oregon last year. You know, Oregon got to Vegas and played Washington the second time, and I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I felt like Washington got better, and Oregon didn't. And Michael Penix and Washington just were a little better than they were the first time the teams met. So, you know, it's you know, the stop one, it's pit stop one on the way to somewhere greater. All right, Anna's coming along for the 5 at 5. We will be joining the NFL game right about 5:15. I want you here for all of it. Anna was hilarious yesterday, out of breath, by the way, heavy breathing yesterday. Will she come into the studio on another warm day in a similar fashion? We shall soon see. Leave it here.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Another very warm day here in the Pacific Northwest. Not as warm as yesterday. Anna, how you doing with the breathing today? Yesterday you were like a caller, a late-night caller, heavy breathing on the show.
I can't promise that I won't be heavy breathing again. I don't know. There's a lot of smoke in the air.
Not in here. Not in the studio.
Not in the studio.
Excuses.
I've been out in the world.
You've been in the world.
In the smoke, in the haze.
Yeah.
I don't know. My chest doesn't feel right. Like, my lungs don't feel right. I'm weak, I guess.
I had an interesting one today because one of my photographers who's shooting the Oregon-Boise State game, I had his credential and his parking pass. So he has his press pass and his his parking pass.
Yeah.
So I had him. I meant to mail it to him earlier in the week.
Yeah.
And he lives in Beaverton.
Okay.
Shout out to Najee. And
he's so talented.
I was texting with him. He's on assignment somewhere else.
Uh-huh.
So he's flying back into Portland tonight, and then he's driving to the Autzen Stadium and shooting that game tomorrow along with Serena Morones. I got two photographers at the Oregon game. I got another one at the San Diego State-Oregon State game. But I told Najee, I'll drive to your house, and I'll put your credential and your parking pass somewhere. I'll hide it somewhere, you know, on your porch or wherever, you know, put it under the mat, whatever that thing is, okay?
Right.
Whatever you're going to do.
Okay.
So he gives me the address, and I look up the house on Google.
Uh-huh.
And it's blue.
Okay.
Okay. And then I drive out to his house. I go, like, deep into Beaverton. That's where he's living.
Yeah.
And I drive to his house, and I pull up, and house doesn't look the same.
You were looking for a blue house.
It's a different color.
Okay.
But I look, check the address. It's the right address. I'm on the right street. So I leave the pass, you know, on his porch. Okay.
Okay.
And then I sent him a text and I said, I left the pass on your porch. I just left it sitting right on the porch.
Uh-huh.
And I said, you know, could you tell your wife it's there or whatever? I didn't want to disrupt the house.
Sure.
But as I'm leaving, I'm having this like feeling like maybe I should check, like make sure it's the right house.
Okay.
So a neighbor happens to be out. In, this lady's in the driveway across the street.
Yeah.
And I rolled my window down and I said, hey, you know, does Najee live there? And the expression on her face was blank.
Okay.
And she was like, I don't know. And I was like, photographer. And she's like, I don't know. And so I was like,
sounds like a friendly neighbor.
You live across the street and you don't know who your neighbor is.
Yeah.
Maybe she was robbing the place across the street.
Maybe.
I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
Seemed nice.
That's my assumption.
So I kind of was getting ready to leave, and then she waved at me.
Uh-huh.
Gave me a thumbs up. Yes, right. Najee. Yes.
Oh.
And I said, I rolled the window down. I said, now wait. You know?
Yeah.
And
did she go research?
She said, I asked my husband. Yeah. Yes. The guy across the street.
The
named
husband
Najee.
Knew.
The husband knew what was going on
That's
in the neighborhood.
Unusual.
Yeah, it was a little juxtaposition.
Usually the husband doesn't know squat.
I don't know any of these people's names in our neighborhood. Okay? Except for Tom and Gary. I know those two guys.
Yeah, you know those guys.
They're sports fans. Yeah. But other than that, I couldn't tell you.
You have names for everybody that are not their actual
That's
names.
Correct. That's correct. And there's one guy I suspect is sight impaired, you know, but based on the way he drives. But every neighborhood's got one. But it just was interesting to me. So I also took a picture of the house just to creep everyone out, and I sent it to Najee.
Did you do, like, the Amazon delivery driver?
I did.
Where you took a photo of the item you left
You're
on the
right.
doorstep with some identifying information?
You're darn right.
You know, a plant, a house plant?
It was his welcome mat. So I said to Najee, I've delivered the package. So he's like, yes, my wife has already got it. All right. So we're good.
Okay.
We are good on that front.
This is a riveting story.
Well, I just thought it was interesting that this lady didn't know who lived across. Do you know who lives across the street from you, Judah? Do you know your neighbors?
I know what they look like.
Do you know their names and their professions?
No.
Wow. What's going on in neighborhoods now?
I know. I'm kind of disappointed in myself. Like, we live pretty close to everybody in our neighborhood, and we don't know anybody. It's crazy. It's like
start talking to him, man.
I should.
It's time to have a barbecue, Judah.
Yeah.
No, you don't have to do that. Just talk to people. I know Najee's
neighbor. I'd rather do the
now.
Barbecue and not talk to people and just eat.
Well, that too. All right, we're gonna do the 5 at 5. Anna's got five great stories.
Okay,
and you're gonna have to move quickly.
Right. Well,
let's do it.
The 5 at 5. Number one.
5 minutes taken up by that neighbor story. So I found this story fascinating. Twitter is currently banned in Brazil. So the NFL reporters who are there to cover tonight's game of the Eagles versus the Green Bay Packers are trying to find workarounds.
Ooh.
This ban only began on August 31st. There's some dispute, of course, between Elon Musk and the Brazilian Supreme Court. It has to do with digital militias. They're upset at Elon Musk. He missed some deadline to find legal representation. So as of a few days ago, Brazil decided to block Twitter in the country. And anyone who is caught using it through like a VPN is subject to a $9,000 fine.
Ouch.
So the sports reporters who are there covering this game are relaying the information to their wives who are tweeting on their behalf.
So you text it to your wife or email it to your wife, and then she will be logged into your Twitter account and tweet it.
Yeah.
Oh, I think Twitter's going to be fun tonight. There's going to be a bunch of tweets from NFL reporters saying, oh, my wife's the best. I love her so much. She's so great.
Like Zach Berman, who covers the Eagles for The Athletic.
Zach. We've had him on the show. Yeah.
Yeah. So his wife posted on there, hey, just a heads up. Like, she posted a photo of herself with her kids, saying, "Just a heads up,
I'm going there.
We're covering the game tonight. We're taking over his account tonight."
I love it. I think it's clever. It's interesting, don't you think?
Yeah.
I'm fascinated to see how this plays out. Moving along. Know your neighbors.
Number two.
This is another story related to that Brazil story. I just find it interesting that the two teams, it really, in all, took more than 3 months, three airplanes and a cargo ship. Yes, a cargo ship to get everything that they needed for that first NFL game in South America. Like, when you talk about all the equipment that they need, the stuff that the team takes with them to try and, you know, acclimate and get ready for the game, that's everything that it took.
It's amazing to me the lengths to which the NFL is going, and college football too, to go play these games in other places. I got to tell you something. I'm not wild about it. I'm not. I think it puts a lot of stress and strain on the players, the support staff, the teams, scheduling. I think it's cool when it's actually happening. It's one of these things where it's like, oh, cool, there's a game in Brazil. But then you think about everything that goes into it and how they have to schedule around it. And even from a college standpoint, it's even worse.
Yeah, they had a preview team. It's a total of 80,000 pounds of equipment per team. And, you know, two travel parties of like 200 each.
Well, we shall see. Get to know your neighbors.
Number three.
You're just going to keep circling back to that point? Okay, let's do this efficiently. Peyton Manning talking about the key reason that Arch Manning did not transfer away from Texas. This is great. So, you know, he redshirted, and he's still not starting. He's still sitting behind Quinn Ewers, but he did throw his first touchdown pass of his college career against Colorado State over the weekend. And Peyton is saying he thinks the kids made the right decision. He said, in this environment, most kids probably wouldn't have stayed, but he went there because he wanted to play there. He wanted to play for Steve Sarkisian, and he's staying there.
I think he's got unusually grounded parents. And, you know, usually athletes who have kids, delusional about their kids just like everyone else. But I think that this family's got its feet on the ground. You know, they don't seem like they're in any hurry, and seem to understand the process more than anything.
Number four.
Real quick, Connor Stallions becomes an interim football coach at a Detroit high school. He's taken over because the head coach suffered a mild stroke last Friday.
Boy.
So the guy behind the Wolverines' alleged sign-stealing scandal is now a head football coach.
Don't bet against that team.
Number five.
And last, national champions in basketball, UConn and South Carolina will visit the White House on Tuesday and meet with Joe Biden.
Cool. Is the White House visit have the allure that it once had? You know, do you think in today's, so much division out
there.
It's
still the White House.
I guess. I mean, I would go.
Yeah.
I would, if invited, I would go.
You would go.
If invited. All right, the bald-faced truth, not here for a long time, just a good time. Enjoy the NFL football.